Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 281 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I've been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts and memoirs and commentaries from gardeners and designers and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, and space. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And, as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. We start this week with Jeanette Marantos' plants column and calendar for events, although we'll share only those calendar events after the 12th of February. The lead into her article, What Trees Survived in Our Terrible Fires, and Why Didn't They Burn? Welcome to February, plant fans. May this month be a respite from LA's hellish, heartbreaking start to 2025. To all who lost family, friends, pets, homes, and jobs in the fires, my colleagues and I send our deepest condolences and love. If only our good wishes could make all this horror go away. We hope that providing factual information, investigations, and guides will help our communities heal. Below you'll find a list of upcoming plant events, but first I want to discuss one of the few happy surprises from the fires that consumed much of Altadena, Pacific Palisades, and parts of Malibu, the many massive trees that survived. Predictably, social media has offered a few unsupported and quite puzzling conspiracy theories that somehow, someone, or something caused the houses to burn for some sinister purpose while saving the trees. CAL FIRE recently posted a more reasoned explanation on Instagram that the fires we saw in Altadena and Pacific Palisades weren't wildfires, which spread from plant to plant, but conflagrations, intense fires propelled by wind that spread from structure to structure, such as from a trellis to a house, to a neighbor's fence, to the neighbor's home. Certain trees survived, according to CAL FIRE, because they have a natural adaptation to withstand fire, such as thick bark, a shape that sheds embers and a higher moisture content than the structures that caught fire. While trees may still be singed, they are often less flammable than structures, according to the post. You can certainly see that in aerial photos of Altadena after the Eaton fire. All you see is the green trees and the gray foundations of the houses that burned, said famed rose breeder Tom Carruth. It was remarkable to me that those trees are still standing there. Carruth and his husband, Rob Kroeger, lost their East Altadena Drive home of 37 years in the Eaton fire that killed 17 people and destroyed more than 9,400 structures. They evacuated the night the fire began on January 7th with their iPads, medications, and little else. They returned the next morning to get Rob's car, just in time to see the roof collapse on their 102-year-old home, which was ablaze. But about 15 feet from the house, their towering deodar cedar was entirely unfazed. If you turn your back to the now ruined house and just look at the front yard, it seems idyllic. A bench under the cedar tree, flower beds dotted with greenery, roses waiting to be pruned, and a scattering of violet sky queen iris in full bloom. Survivors of the fire recall fist-sized embers driven by the fierce Santa Ana winds pummeling homes and yards. Seeing the deodar completely untouched, that surprised me the most, said Carruth, a former rose breeder for Weeks Roses, who is now curator of the Rose Garden at the Huntington Library Art Museum and Botanical Gardens. Deodar cedars are evergreen conifers native to the Himalayas in areas between Afghanistan and Tibet, but they also grow happily around many parts of Altadena. The biggest collection is on Santa Rosa Avenue, where about 135 deodar cedars stretch for nearly a mile, supporting the community's 104-year-old holiday lighting tradition known as Christmas Tree Lane. Longtime Santa Rosa Avenue resident Tony Ward described watching the fire rain giant embers down from the foothills the night of January 7th. They would strike the trees, the deodar cedars, and burst into little sparklers, he said. Most of the embers went out, but this was something we'd never experienced before. Many other large conifers, like pines, survived the fires too. In fact, many of the biggest survivors appear to be evergreens, such as conifers and native oak trees, said fire safety educator and landscape architect Doug Kent, who recently visited the burn areas in Altadena. The oaks did an incredible job. They really lived up to their mythology as fire catchers, Kent said. And the camphors, which are not native, did a great job too. They're a popular evergreen tree with a big open canopy like an umbrella with reddish green leaves. Kent, who regularly gives talks about creating fire-resistant landscapes, believes the large trees served as windbreaks that buffered the hurricane force Santa Ana winds that reportedly gusted over 80 miles an hour. Wind behaves like water does. If you put an object in front of water, you get an eddy effect where it swirls around the object. If you put a wall up like a tree, the firebrands, embers, are stopped and they fall to the ground. This is why it's important to ensure you don't have branches overhanging your roof or pushing against your home, even when you plant so-called fire catchers like oaks, Kent said. You don't want those firebrands to drop on your roof or against your house. Kent thinks it also helped that the surviving trees, such as the deodar cedars, were likely more irrigated than trees in the wild, so had a higher moisture content. What about trees that didn't fare so well in the fire, or worse, spread the flames? That's harder to determine. Native shrubs such as toyon, lemonade berry, and manzanita burned to stumps as the fire swept through Eaton Canyon, said Christian Mace, natural areas biologist for the Los Angeles County Parks and Recreation. But that doesn't mean the roots are killed. These fires evolved in fire habitats, and they will come back, I guarantee you. Mace was thrilled, however, by how well the oaks and sycamores fared around the Eaton Canyon Nature Center, which burned to the ground. Every mature sycamore I saw in the canyon had some dark scarring on their bases, but that was it, she said. And almost all of the oaks came through just a little singed, so both trees proved their hardiness. In my very unscientific survey, I saw plenty of palm trees with blackened trunks and crispified tops, along with tall, skinny, highly flammable Italian cypress and arborvitae that looked like charred poles. But in fairness, I also saw many eucalyptus, palms, and cypress that seemed unscathed, growing just feet away from the smoldering remains of houses. Sometimes it's the luck of the draw or the direction of the wind, said Altadena native Rebecca Latta, a biologist and certified arborist. When the fire's hot enough, it doesn't matter what you do. But I'm concerned that people are vilifying the trees, Latta said. Houses are concentrated fuel sources, and what we saw here is that trees got burned by the houses next to them burning, not vice versa. Latta's biggest concern now is that well-meaning people may start cutting down singed oaks and conifers without realizing they'll likely survive. there's so much angst in the community right now about all the people coming in and doing stuff that might not be carefully considered, she said. Those trees are part of Altadena's identity, and we shouldn't be hasty about removing them unless they're clearly gone. I'm sure researchers will be studying the long-term effects of the fires on those trees and shrubs, but the best and hardest advice the experts have now is to wait and see what comes back. In the meantime, especially as our drought persists, make sure the trees around your home stay hydrated. Every couple of weeks, turn your hose to a trickle and water under your trees for a few hours to ensure the water sinks deep. And pray for more rain. We now move to upcoming Southern California garden events. Throughout the month of February, Seniors Free Month at the San Diego Zoo Safari Park and Botanic Collection is offering free admission to visitors 65 or older during the month of February. SDZSAFARI Park, all one word, San Diego's Zoo and Safari Park, .org. We focus now on events beginning the 12th of February. On February 22nd, the Palos Verdes Peninsula Land Conservancy Native Plant Sale. It is at the White Point Nature Education Center in San Pedro on February 22nd. Admission is free. PVPLC.org is the website. On February 9, 12, 15, 18, and 26, the Master Gardeners of Orange County present Grow It Now Warm Season Vegetables to teach how to select and grow warm season vegetables in your garden. These free classes are offered at 5 locations and times. February 12th from 10 to 11 at the Fullerton Community Center. February 15th from 2 to 3 at the Laguna Beach Public Library. February 18th from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Westminster Senior Center, and February 26th from 6 to 7 in the Yorba Linda Public Library, mgorange.ucanr.edu. On February 14th and 15th, the Adult Night Hike, Body Botany, from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Los Angeles County Arboretum. Discover the botany of love and lust, such as the potions that got ancient Romans in the mood. Participants must be 18 or older. Advanced registration required, $25, $20 for members, arboretum.org. On February 15th, March 1 and 15, Climate Gardening 101, a month-long course offered by tree people to examine how cultivated urban landscapes can impact climate adaptation. The course includes 3 in-person sessions from 9 a.m. to noon at the Tree People headquarters at Coldwater Canyon Park in Beverly Hills, along with 4 virtual sessions. The cost is $20. Register online, treepeople.org. On February 20th, Propagating California Native Plants from Seed with Ella Anderson, a certified horticulturist and chief botanical technician for the Theodore Payne Foundation. Participants receive seed kits with reusable flats, pots, and plug trays, plus 10 species of cool season native plant seed. Register online, $92.55, $81.88 for members, eventbrite.com. And remember, Eventbrite is EVENTBRITE, eventbrite.com. February 21, 22, and 27, Hollywood at the Arboretum Walking Tour, 2 to 3:30 on February 21, 22, and 27, with a fourth tour from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on February 22nd at the Los Angeles County Arboretum. See the locations and hear the stories about how the Arboretum has been used as a backdrop for films, television shows, commercials, and videos since the 1930s. The tour is free with advanced registration and $15 admission to the Arboretum, $11 for seniors 62 plus and students with ID, $5 for children 5 through 12, free to children 4 and under, and Arboretum members. Arboretum.com is the website. And who remembers that opening call? The plane, boss. See the plane. February 22nd, California Native Plant Propagation Workshop at the Tree of Life Nursery in San Juan Capistrano from 10 to 11 a.m. Admission is free, but advance registration is required. California Native Plants, all one word, .com. Also on the 22nd, Santa Ana Winds and Our Ecosystem, a Theodore Payne Foundation class taught by naturalist William Selby, author of The California Sky Watcher, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Register online, $39.19, $33.85 for members, eventbrite.com. On February 25th, March 4th, and March 11th, Matilla Habab's Gardening with Native Plants, a three-session class offered by Conejo Valley Adult Education from 5:45 to 7:15 each night in Thousand Oaks. The class is taught by Bob Sussman, owner of Matilaha Nursery in Moorpark. Register online for the $65 course, evae.asapconnected.com. And February 28th to April 6th, Tomato Mania returns to Southern California for its 25th year. The pop-up vendor returns with more than 100 different varieties of tomatoes and peppers, starting at its first location at Rogers Gardens Nursery in Corona Del Mar from February 28th to March 9th, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. daily. Tomato Mania is visiting 10 sites around the region this spring. Their schedule is listed online at tomatomania.com. An article by Jeanette Marantos, published in the Los Angeles Times on February 1, What Trees Survived in Our Terrible Fires and Why Didn't They Burn?, as well as a summary of upcoming events for the last 2 weeks of February, all printed on February 1 in the Los Angeles Times. We move next to another article by Jeanette Marantos, this one published on the 25th of January in the Los Angeles Times. My house didn't burn, but ash from the LA fires fell in my yard. Can I eat from my garden? Is my soil safe? Highlights include the following. Unlike ash from vegetation fires, ash from burning buildings usually contains many toxins from melted plastics, electronics, and other common household items. Multiple federal, state, and local agencies are working to clean up more than 16,000 homes and other structures damaged or destroyed in Pacific Palisades and Altadena. At present, it appears people who didn't have fire damage need to clean their own ash. Testing your soil might be the best way to determine if it's safe. In the meantime, wash garden vegetables thoroughly before eating and carefully remove as much ash as possible without making it airborne. In the world of wildfires, there are basically two kinds of ash. The good kind from burned vegetation that enriches the soil, and the very bad ash from urban wildfires that's created when everyday items like plastics, electronics, couches, and tires burn along with people's offices, homes, and stores. Ash from a chaparral vegetation fire is clean. It contains nutrients like phosphorus and potassium that can be beneficial, said Garn Wallace, a biochemist and soil scientist whose business, Wallace Laboratories in El Segundo, has been testing California soil since 1990. But ash from a home that burned risks having heavy metals that came from the construction materials or were used in the paint or furniture. And ash from that house could be toxic. Therefore, multiple federal, state, and local agencies, including the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department of Toxic Substances Control, are working to clean up more than 16,000 homes and other structures in Pacific Palisades and Altadena, and have been tasked with assessing, removing, and disposing of hazardous materials, such as ash, around those burned-up structures. Because of the danger from toxins, Los Angeles County has prohibited residents from cleaning up properties that were damaged or destroyed in burn areas until a hazardous materials inspection is completed by an approved government agency. But what about residents whose homes didn't burn, but whose yards and gardens still got a coating of ash? At present, there don't appear to be any cleanup programs or prohibitions for properties with ash contamination, but no other fire damage. In other words, it appears you'll have to handle those kinds of cleanups yourself. It's best to carefully corral and dispose of ash on your property to keep your household safe. Pets can track potentially toxic ash into the house or lick it off their paws. Children can get it on their hands and clothes and even in their mouths. And every time you work in your garden, you're potentially exposing yourself to toxins in the ash, such as heavy metals, including lead or VOCs, volatile organic compounds like benzene, a carcinogen that can create serious health issues after long-term exposure. With this in mind, here are answers from health, soil, and gardening experts who've studied the subject when it comes to navigating the task of cleaning up ash and other toxins. How can I protect myself when I work around ash from recent LA area wildfires? Whether you work with a professional to clean up your yard or take on the matter yourself, you need to stay safe. At a minimum, wear an N95 mask and sturdy gloves before working in a yard doused with ash to protect yourself from inhaling or absorbing potentially toxic metals or chemicals. Safer still is wearing safety goggles, long pants, long-sleeve shirts and boots to minimize contact with eyes and skin. Remove your boots and clothing at the door and clean them thoroughly so you don't track ash into the house or leave it on furniture. Since young children tend to put everything in their mouths, it's best to keep them and their toys inside until after the ash has been removed. The same goes for pets. Keep them indoors as much as possible, and when they do go outside, be sure to wipe off their feet and coats so they don't track it inside or ingest it by licking their paws. Do everything to keep the ash from going airborne. The Los Angeles County Department of Public Health issued an emergency order January 10th prohibiting the use of leaf blowers and other power air blowers countywide. That order was revised January 23rd to prohibit use of those types of blowers in Palisades and Eaton wildfire perimeter areas only. However, the county's health department still recommends that people outside the burn areas consider alternatives to the use of power air blowers for removing ash, such as gentle sweeping followed by wet mopping or HEPA vacuum so the particles don't become airborne and easily inhaled. What's the best way to remove ash from yards in non-fire areas? If you're dealing with ash problems outside the burn areas, researchers recommend dampening the ash first, and then either gently sweeping or shoveling as much as possible into plastic bags that can be tightly closed and put in the garbage. Remember to wear personal protective gear while doing this so you don't inhale the dust. Gardeners with raised beds who had a lot of urban wildfire ash should consider removing the top 6 inches of soil as well and disposing of it in plastic bags in the trash. Then add fresh soil to the beds, Wallace said. Do not put the ash or contaminated soil into green bins or compost piles because it could contain toxins or, at the very least, high alkalinity that could be harmful to plants. Also, make sure the ash is tightly contained in a plastic bag, even double bag, so it can't spill out of the trash and become airborne. If you have a shop vac with a HEPA filter that can suck, not blow, the ash into a plastic bag, you can try using that on impermeable surfaces such as driveways or patios, or even in garden beds. Just make sure the vacuum doesn't send the ash flying. Is it safe for me to eat produce from a garden that was covered in ash? Yes, as long as you remove the ash by washing the produce thoroughly, according to Dr. Gina Solomon, chief of the Division of Occupational Environmental and Climate Medicine at UC San Francisco. Researchers at UC Cooperative Extension of Sonoma County, who studied the effects of wildfire on soil and produce, recommend removing outer leaves and peels in addition to giving any ash-covered produce a thorough washing. After a series of urban wildfires in 2017, the UC Cooperative Extension of Sonoma County studied the effects of smoke on soil, produce, chicken, and egg production in areas that were not adjacent to the burned structures. The department created a webinar and website about its findings, concluding there was low concern of health impacts from ingesting produce exposed to the Santa Rosa urban wildfire smoke of 2017. They determined that the benefits of growing and eating fresh leafy greens, such as kale, outweighed any long-term cancer risk. The Sonoma County researchers also concluded that produce must be thoroughly washed before it's eaten. This is particularly important for produce like root vegetables, which have direct contact with the ground. Peeling vegetables such as carrots or potatoes and removing outer leaves of lettuce or spinach will help remove any contaminants that might be clinging to the food. Gardeners can soak their produce in a solution of 1 cup white vinegar to 9 cups clean water to better remove the ash, then rinse the produce thoroughly under running water to remove the vinegar. If the food is too delicate for good washing, say tender lettuce leaves, then it might be time to discard that produce and take a trip to the farmer's market or grocery store to buy a replacement, Solomon said. Especially for people who are more vulnerable to toxins, such as children, people who are pregnant, or people with underlying health issues. Wallace had one proviso. If the fruit or vegetables have been scorched or damaged by fire, it's possible toxins or heavy metals have embedded in the food, and it should be discarded. If the leaves are still green and the plant looks healthy, the produce should be fine, even if it's dusted with ash. But if it's scorched, it could contain metals that won't wash off. How will ash affect my plants? Ashy coatings can stunt growth by blocking sunlight to the plant. Wash ash off your plants with a garden hose as soon as possible, or hope for a good rain to keep the plants healthy. On a side note, Solomon noted ash is corrosive, so it's a good idea to rinse it off your vehicles as soon as possible to keep it from damaging the finish. When washing off your plants, try to keep the water on your soil. That might add more contaminants to your soil, but it's better than spreading the toxins by flushing it down drain or gutters, according to the South Coast Air Quality Management District. Is my soil safe for planting a new vegetable garden? This question is harder to answer, said Wallace, whose lab is one of the few in Southern California that tests for heavy metals in soil, as well as nutrients and alkaline levels. Labs that perform similar tests include Alluvial Soil Lab in Anaheim, Pinnacle Laboratory in Lawndale, Vert Environmental in Placentia, LA Testing in Huntington Beach, and Babcock Laboratories in Riverside. A light dusting of ash probably won't do much damage to your soil, said Wallace, but a thick layer could raise the alkaline levels above 8, making it difficult for plants to grow, and lace the soil with heavy metals such as lead. In that case, the safest bet is to test your soil to see if its pH is too high. That means an alkalinity over 8, or if it's tainted with contaminants. Test prices range between $100 and $200, depending on what the tests entail. Wallace Laboratories, for instance, charge $100 to test for pH levels, salinity, fertility, nutrients in the soil, and trace heavy metals such as lead and arsenic. 1-2 to 3-cup samples of ash can provide information about soil contamination for an entire neighborhood, Wallace said. The results should not vary much from house to house, he said. Wallace said officials are most likely to find high levels of lead in the ash because many of the buildings that burned, especially in the Eaton Fire, were old enough to have used lead-based paints. Like most cities, many parts of Los Angeles already had issues with lead contamination in the soil, he said. Up until the late 1950s, the city had people incinerate their trash in their backyard. Every older home in West LA has an incinerator footprint where it burned trash, and it's full of lead, Wallace said. Also, lead was used in paints and gasoline for automobiles until the 1970s. The bad news about lead is that it binds to soil particles, he said. It will not wash away. The hopeful news is that lead doesn't move much, he said. It tends to stay near the surface in the top 6 inches of the soil, so it's relatively easy to remove. Wallace said he tested his soil when he purchased his house in Westwood many decades ago and discovered it had lead contamination. He had hired contractors to install a swimming pool, but he instructed them to first scrape about 6 inches of soil off his entire yard and dispose of it, then dig an additional 2 feet in the pool area and use that soil to create planting beds around his yard. He also regularly adds compost to his planting beds, he said, because studies have shown these organic materials can dilute lead in the soil. Tim Becker, horticultural director for the Theodore Payne Foundation, said he tested the soil in his West Adams yard a few years ago and discovered it had lead concentrations of around 65 parts per million, near the state limit of 80 parts per million. But after researching lead contamination, he decided to go ahead and plant some vegetables. Research such as this 2016 study by the University of Washington indicates the risk of lead poisoning is low in urban gardens because, with the exception of root vegetables, plants take little lead into their stems and leaves. Runner beans, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, those things are still safe to eat, Becker said. But I don't plant root vegetables like carrots or beets. Nothing could cause cross-contamination of the soil or consuming soil directly. Becker said his biggest concern is about children playing in contaminated soil. Consumption of soil by children is the biggest risk for lead, he said. You have to do your homework and decide what's right for you. You can always raise food in potting soil in containers or raised beds. What else can I do to improve my soil quality? Research has shown that certain plants such as yarrow, mugwort, and sunflowers can draw heavy metals and other contaminants from the soil in a process known as phytoremediation. After all this oppressive smoke and gray ash, this sounds like an easy and excellent balm for many local communities. Tall rows of cheerful sunflowers can provide badly needed food and refuge for insects and birds while magically and majestically improving the soil. An extensive article by Jeanette Marantos, a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times, who focuses primarily on plants gardening and Southern California's changing landscape. This article in the plants section of the Times was published on January 25th. My house didn't burn, but ash from the LA fires fell in my yard. Can I eat from my garden? Is my soil safe? We turn our focus to the future with our next article by S.J. McShane, published in Martha Stewart Living at the end of January. 9 landscaping trends that will transform your outdoor space in 2025. Landscapers say these trends will dominate home exteriors this year. The world of landscaping is transforming from a focus on visual aesthetics to natural and sustainable practices. While the traditional manicured lawn still holds charm for sun, many homeowners want a wilder look. This emerging trend encourages landscapers and gardeners to experiment with colorful wildflowers and lush native grasses rather than spending time and money on maintaining turf. Gone or going are the days when pristine striped green lawns with little to no biodiversity, box-trimmed hedges, and volcano-style mulch beds were seen as the pinnacle of a high-end landscape, says Cameron DePaola, owner and landscape designer at Riverside Group, LLC. Current landscaping trends favor a bold aesthetic, incorporating vibrant colors in practical, low-maintenance ways. The result goes beyond the visually striking landscape. These natural spaces also play a crucial role in nurturing a rich ecosystem. Wildflowers and native plants invite beneficial insects and pollinators to your landscape, creating a harmonious balance between beauty and nature. Ahead, landscape professionals share rising landscaping trends they predict will take over outdoor space in 2025. The two experts, Cameron DePaola, owner and landscape designer at Riverside Group, LLC, and Christopher Simon, a design consultant with Riverside Group in Maine. The trends include the following: edible landscape. Edible landscaping is becoming popular among homeowners who want fresh produce without the commitment of a traditional vegetable garden. Rather than tilling large plots or managing intensive watering and weeding schedules, people are integrating herbs, fruit bushes, and smaller vegetable plants directly into ornamental beds. This saves space, conserves water, and reduces labor, yielding a vibrant, functional landscape that provides fresh ingredients while maintaining a low-maintenance aesthetic, says DePaola. Climate resilient and storm resistant. Climate resilience and storm resistance have become central concerns, especially for coastal landscapes. The heightened frequency of storms combined with rising sea levels has led to a thorough reevaluation of design and maintenance practices near the water, says DePaola. There's a growing emphasis on durable seawalls, erosion control, and careful shoreline planning. Whether it's shifting plantings away from surge zones, building protective berms, or using hardy ground covers that tolerate wind, water, and salt, the focus is on combining form, function, and sustainability. This approach safeguards properties from future weather events while preserving the natural beauty and ecological balance of coastal environments. Naturalistic hardscaping. Naturalistic hardscaping focuses on locally sourced stone, reclaimed wood, and other organic materials instead of uniform pavers. DePaola explains that these elements blend seamlessly with the surrounding terrain, avoiding the stark lines and artificial feel of conventional hardscape. Permeable surfaces like stone paths also aid drainage and reduce runoff. natural stone, and wood acquire a patina over time, adding a timeless quality and highlighting the landscape's rugged beauty. Smart irrigation. Smart irrigation systems have many benefits, including water conservation, reduced maintenance, and healthier landscapes. Weather-based controls and soil moisture sensors supply water only where and when needed, minimizing runoff and weed growth, says Christopher Simon, a design consultant with Riverside Group. With less overwatering, plants need fewer chemicals and less frequent care. Simon explains that this approach aligns with sustainability goals by lowering utility costs, integrating easily with eco-friendly designs. Refined color palettes. Designs for 2025 showcase refined color palettes, echoing trends in both landscape and interior design, says Simon. Soft neutrals and warm grays provide understated backdrops, allowing bolder plant selections to shine. Taupe, grayish, green, and black can tie together stone pathways, planters, and fences, she says. Meanwhile, bold accents come in the form of aubergine, deep blues or greens, terracotta, and sunset palettes of warm oranges, pinks, and corals. The result is a harmonious balance of subtlety and vibrancy. No-mow or xeriscaping. No-mow alternatives to traditional turf are gaining popularity for their low maintenance and eco-friendly advantages. Replacing grass with natural meadows or xeriscapes, designed for minimal water usage, greatly decreases the need for mowing, irrigation, and fertilizers. Clover, tall fescues, moss, or other ground covers maintain greenery without intensive labor, while meadows of native grasses and wildflowers boost biodiversity, says Simon. Xeriscapes prioritize drought-tolerant plants and hardscaping suitable for regions with water restrictions. These methods reduce resource use and create visually appealing landscapes that harmonize with the environment. Outdoor wellness spaces. As more individuals prioritize their mental and physical health, outdoor wellness spaces are becoming increasingly popular. From secluded meditation corners to yoga decks and spa-like water features, these areas are designed to be calm, private retreats within the broader landscape, says De Paola. They often include calming elements such as fragrant plants, soft lighting, and tranquil soundscapes, which help individuals de-stress and reconnect with nature at home. Sculptural elements and biophilic art. Designers are increasingly experimenting with sculptural accents, living walls, and art installations to connect nature with design aesthetics. Whether it's a piece of metalwork in a courtyard or a vertical garden along a fence, these artistic touches add visual intrigue, says De Paola. By incorporating natural materials and organic forms, homeowners can appreciate local craftsmanship and showcase the character of their outdoor spaces. Native and biodiverse planting. While native and biodiverse plantings have been popular for years, they will continue to widen their reach in 2025. While native often refers to local species, the broader goal is reducing environmental impact while creating a visually appealing and productive landscape. Low-maintenance, edible, and pollinator-friendly plants offer aesthetic value and environmental benefits, all with minimal upkeep. This original article was published in Martha Stewart Magazine, written by S.J. McCain, 9 Landscaping Trends That Will Transform Your Outdoor Space in 2025. Those include edible landscaping, climate-resilient and storm-resistant, naturalistic hardscaping, smart irrigation, refined color palettes, no-mow or xeriscaping, outdoor wellness spaces, sculpture elements and biophilic art, and native and biodiverse planting. That wraps up edition 281, Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program developed and produced for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send your comments at www.lars.org, L-A-R-R-S, or email us at oneword, laradioreading@gmail.com. You have suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think of the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us, even as we try to create order and structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty and of persistence, even sometimes of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, or planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky. Gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.